You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Friday, May 15th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Casual Friday, folks. You know what that means. Cliff Schechter will be joining us. Also on the program, ostensibly to give me a movie recommendation for the weekend, the comedian Judy Gold. Also on the program today, remember how 2 days ago we said Jeb Bush, if he knew then what he knew now, he would have voted for the Iraq War. But then he said, no, it was if he knew then what he knew then, he would have voted for the Iraq War. And then how yesterday he said, or the day before that, he said, it's really not appropriate to even ask him because it's bad for the troops to ask him those type of questions. Well, tomorrow, if he knew what he did 2 days ago, he would have said that he would not have gone into Iraq. And that, come on, guys, let's stop making a big deal of this. Also on the program today, remember how the president said Elizabeth Warren was out of her mind to suggest that somehow the TPP could affect Dodd-Frank? Well, it turns out that NAFTA may very well affect the Volcker Rule. So apparently, she's in her mind. And the last intact section of the largest Antarctica ice shelves, bye-bye. Probably going to go soon. Also, turns out that there's a warm-blooded fish, and I have a prediction. Well, here's my prediction, ladies and gentlemen, about this story about the warm-blooded fish. I don't know if you've seen this, but we've all been told for years, at least the past couple of years, I'd say probably the last 2 years I've been told this. No, I mean, I grew up. This is what you grow up learning, right? That mammals are warm-blooded, and I guess birds too, right? And that fish are cold-blooded. They live underwater, if you weren't aware of what fish do. Well, it turns out there's a warm-blooded fish, or there's a story today in Science magazine that says that scientists have discovered a warm-blooded fish. Apparently it lives way, way, way deep down. And it's one of the most active fish down there because apparently when you live that deep in the water, you get to be very lazy. But I point this out not because I understand the significance of it or I know that it's significant, but I don't understand the significance of it. In 10 minutes, I'm going to forget that there's a warm-blooded fish, just like 4 hours ago, I had forgotten that I remembered that there was only, you know, that mammals are warm-blooded. You know, Mila has brought it up occasionally because she's in fourth grade, and this is the type of stuff. But after that, it just hasn't really occurred to me. But I will make this prediction right now. That by Monday, maybe Tuesday at the latest, we will be able to find an example. Let's call this by Tuesday's show, okay? Maybe we won't be able to. We will be able to find an example of a right-wing talker or politician or somebody will say that this story is an argument as to why global warming is not proven. Because they're going to say, like, look, for years, for millennia, we thought there was no warm-blooded fish, and then it turns out to be the case. That's why you cannot trust the science of global warming and why we should just hold off and watch the world melt. That is my prediction, ladies and gentlemen. It's Casual Friday, so I'm going to go out on a limb. There you have it. Folks, just a reminder, this program is supported by you, our listeners. For 90%, I would say, of our revenue. However, this month, starting today until June 15th, America's only progressive phone company, Credo Mobile, are sponsoring the Majority Report, and they got a special offer for our listeners. This is huge, folks. $100 off of any phone, plus 25% off your data plan fees for 1 year when you sign up for Credo Mobile. You can get all the best-selling phones that you've ever heard of. You have access to when you join Credo. Go to credomobile.com/majority report. Get the $100 off all phones, the 25% off the data plan for 1 year. You also, on top of that, they will buy you out of your existing, if there's any type of like early termination fee for your existing phone, they will give you up to $350 credit on your Credo bill if you have to pay for that. Plus, they'll give you a $300 trade-in credit for your current phone. So check all that out. Go to credomobile.com/majority report. And then you use the coupon code, or you can just call if you want, 800-966-1665. Use the offer code 501-882. You can find that at support our sponsors link at majority.fm. You can keep your current phone number. And remember, Credo, and we're going to have some folks on from Credo over the next month or so talk about some of their campaigns they're doing, also what they're doing. You've heard them in the past on this program before talking about their campaigns. So I'm very happy to have them as a sponsor. But you also know that Credo supports progressive groups like Democracy Now!, 350.org, Project Vote, Planned Parenthood. They give 1%, I believe it is, of their revenues. But we will be talking more about this as we go on. But check it out. credomobile.com/majority report. All right, quick break, and then we're going to talk to Cliff Schechter. We are back, ladies and gentlemen. It is Casual Friday. And as I say every week, you know what that means. It means this.
Cliff Shack Dives, Libertas LLC. New media, public relations, and strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Shack Dives, Libertas LLC.
Hello, Cliff Schechter.
Hello there, Samuel.
Cliff, you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you sort of like cut off at the end there. I don't know. Did you call me Samuel C?
It was supposed to be Cedar.
All right. Fair enough.
What happened?
Cliff, how are you this week?
I am doing quite well. How about yourself?
I'm doing all right. This week was a very strange week. With this Amtrak debacle, I mean, and really a tragedy. 8 people lost their lives, 200 injured, it was. I got to say, I was stunned to watch the Republicans insist on voting to cut funding the day, like literally when they're still pulling people out. I mean, still. Finding dead people in the wreckage.
It's amazing. There are times where I honestly question if they're human. It's really a jarring thing for me. A friend of mine actually lost a friend on that train because a friend of mine is the head of mobile products at the AP, and an AP reporter, which you may have read about, was on that train and was killed. So that's really sad. It reminds me in a way, you know, obviously a much, much, much smaller version of 9/11 where I felt like, first of all, I knew some people who lost people and knew some people myself. And then on top of that, you think to yourself, if it's someplace where you often were, I mean, until I ended up meeting my wife and moving out to the Midwest, my entire life was basically growing up in New York, going to college in Philly, and living in Washington, D.C. for 8 years. I must have taken that train line 250 times, you know, probably more. So it's disturbing in a whole lot of ways. You have to, what the Republicans, of course, never react to these things. They act like nothing happened and we're just supposed to move on. So just keep cutting funding for Amtrak, even though already Amtrak funding has been cut to the bone. Already there are safety measures, the automatic brakes that will set in if it's going too quickly, a positive train, something or other. I can't remember the third name. But it's, you know, that could have been in place, but aren't completely in place yet. I mean, you know, I feel like it's the same old discussions here. I mean, this is just another reminder. Essentially, we have a group of people that act and think and sort of emote like infants. They are children, essentially, who can't accept anything about a modern society from the fact that, you know, we all rely on each other to a certain degree when you live in a society, the fact that some people are gay, to the fact that some people disagree with you on things. They can't stand any of that. And in a modern industrial society, that gets people killed. And the problem is they have essentially taken over the primary process of one of our two major parties. And so this used to be something, I mean, infrastructure is something the Chamber of Commerce supports spending on. It's not like this is a neat partisan issue of Democrats versus Republicans. This is really more Tea Party versus everybody, because Chamber of Commerce type Republicans, if they weren't scared they're going to get destroyed in a primary, would support this.
I don't know that they would support Amtrak per se, because they don't. There's the idea of some type of, you know, trains fundamentally are sort of like public transport. I don't know that they would support Amtrak, but they would certainly support more infrastructure spending.
Well, infrastructure and transportation, because, you know,
but it would be more
a Chamber of Commerce. Right. Well, it may not be Amtrak. It may be something private. Who knows what it would be? But I mean, look, Eisenhower built the highways. I mean, there was a time Republicans understood that if you by building the kind of infrastructure that allowed people with skills to get from one place to another was a way of helping the economy. Not only did it provide jobs while you were doing it, it increases productivity. I mean, you need to get from A to B. You can't do it always on a highway, or, you know, you couldn't do it on a gravel road, so there were highways. You couldn't do it, you know, once a highway gets filled with people in certain cities and areas, we have that, you know, having public transportation is a way to do that. And you look at, you know, I read this piece that I had sent you, you may have already seen it, that was in New Yorker. I mean, we used to spend 5% of our GDP on that. So this, it did get bipartisan support way back when.
Right, and now, you know, we're at about like 2.5%.
We're about 2.5%. You know, most of Europe spends 5%. China and Japan spend 10%. Singapore. There's a reason why China is building tunnels through mountains, and they're the ones who are getting this enormous productive economy, and we've got infrastructure. Our trains are still crossing certain bridges that are 125 years old. It's ridiculous. And the thing is that what gets me mad is that the way this should be framed, and it never is by people, Democrats and, frankly, any common sense Republicans, you know, is that clearly that they always want to say this crap, if you don't want to go to a war, you hate this country. No, they hate this country because it's embarrassing. It is, you know, it, not only are you getting people killed, it's embarrassing when our infrastructure by the World Economic Forum is ranked 25th in the world behind Oman. It's embarrassing when our bridges are falling. It's embarrassing when we're behind Europe, we're behind Asia. Clearly, you tell me if you love this country, if you want this country to be a wreck and falling apart, because I can't believe you really do.
It's not just that we're, you know, 25th in terms of maintaining this infrastructure. We're trending in the wrong way. It's not like, you know, we're scurrying to catch up. They're cutting Amtrak's budget. I mean, they're literally cutting it, not cutting the rate of growth, even though since 2000 we've seen a huge uptick in the amount of people who are using it. They're cutting the actual budget. And let's be clear on this about, because there was a big there was a fight in Congress about this, and certainly Boehner has had to address this as well. The idea that this accident could have been prevented with more funding, it seems to be the case. You mentioned the positive train control system. Apparently, according to the Times yesterday, that train that derailed in Philadelphia was equipped with the positive train control system. This is basically where the train communicates with certain portions of the track, and the certain portions of the track emit some type of a radio signal that basically say speed should not be greater than X at this juncture. And in this case, it was because it's a near 90 degree angle. I don't know. Maybe it's closer to 45. And it
would automatically slow the train down.
So it was equipped with this, but because of the lack of funding, it created further delays in Amtrak's ability to actually buy the frequency that was needed to rent
that portion of the track. In other words, it's on some parts of it, but it's not on other parts.
Exactly.
According
to a briefing for congressional staff members that was held yesterday morning, the transponders were on the tracks, but they weren't operational because of the ongoing spectrum issue. In other words, they hadn't been able to afford or purchase the wireless spectrum that was needed. And earlier than now, it's actually supposed to go into effect in the next couple of months. So this is actually a specific case where more funding would have. And this is a quote directly from one of the members.
The NTSB.
From the NTSB, this guy, Robert Sumholt. He said, positive train control would have prevented the accident, period.
I mean, so that's the thing, is that this was completely preventable. It's another one of these things where we refuse to regulate something, whether it ends up being, you know, in West Texas, the factory that blew up because the EPA wasn't, you know, they prevented the EPA from coming in and properly regulating, I guess it was a fertilizer factory, whether it's the gun stuff I end up talking about all the time because we refuse to regulate those. We just, you know, I mean, so many of these things are preventable, and this is why in all these indicators, the United States is falling.
Well, but the irony of this is, in 2008, the Congress basically ordered the installation of these positive control systems.
After a crash.
Yes. And then subsequent to that, of course, Congress wouldn't provide the money for it.
Right, which is the other part of it that always matters. I mean, it's just it's a tragedy, and it's so angering in that capacity. But it's also angering when you read the distances that these trains are going in China. The fact that we have trains in existence now that could go between Washington D.C. and Miami in about 5 hours. You know, I mean, and it takes frankly 3.5 just to get from New York to Washington. You know, and I'm trying to remember who wrote a piece about this the other day. I think it may have been Michael Tomasky at the Daily Beast, who wrote that he was reading something and was shocked that there was in the past, and this is what you're talking about, us going backwards, the trains used to actually go between New York and Washington in the 60s in about 2.5 hours. It has gotten an hour slower because of all of the delays. Like, that's ridiculous. I mean, you know, we're 50 years later and we're now going slower. That's insane. And it affects everything because, of course, it affects – that's why so many more people run to the airport. That's why there are airport delays. I mean, there's a ripple effect of the fact that we refuse to do any of this. And I mean, it's win, win, win. It would create jobs. It would be a stimulus. It would raise wages. There's plenty of people who've lost industrialized jobs that have the kinds of skills you would need for these kinds of projects. In every way, we would win. But, you know, that's usually the way it is with these Tea Party ignoramuses, is that if everything is a positive, they'll go in the other direction.
There was and I can't remember what the issue was, but there was a hearing where Al Franken and somebody had sent it to me recently, even though I think it was from 2011, even maybe. Al Franken, Bernie Sanders in a committee debating with Rand Paul. Rand Paul was saying,
yeah, I saw that recently,
are you
too.
Telling me that by spending money we can save money? How does that work?
I know.
And it's like, oh, my God. Seriously? I honestly believe that any average 15-year-old understands the concept of, like, we do preventative maintenance. It's going to save me in the long run.
Right.
You know, the reason why you take your car in to get your oil changed. I'm going to spend $40 on changing my oil. That's going to save me money. How does that
only
work?
Only in Washington can you say that'll happen.
Honestly, I mean, this is the thing that's sort of just amazing. When we talk about infrastructure, we're talking about investments in the future. And, you know, and you hear so much about we're leaving, yes, it can be insulating your house. I mean, there's a million different other examples. But the idea, you know, I don't know, buying a new refrigerator.
Well,
if you have a 25-year-old refrigerator,
for us,
you
still have electricity. Obamacare.
Happens
saves
all the time.
God knows how much money.
But we hear so much about saddling our grandchildren with debt. That's what this is.
That's why the framing needs to just be different on our side, because that's what this is. When you don't take care of people's health, when you don't take care of the infrastructure of our society, when you allow all these public health risks to continue without taking care of them, when you do all these things, that's going to saddle people with debt, because those costs are eventually going to go through the roof, you know? And it makes me embarrassed that I'm in the same country as these idiots.
Well, we're going to note that when you try and run for office, that you're embarrassed about America.
Don't even worry about it. No, don't you go misquoting me, you negative campaigner. I didn't say I'm embarrassed about America. I'm embarrassed that these guys have
we're
influence
cut that out.
In my country.
Out
I know you're not. You're going to be like, Cliff says that. It'll be like a bunch of words you
right.
put together.
Were you always embarrassed by America?
About America sucks.
Yes.
Hate it.
Were you always embarrassed by America?
Racism. Good. You know, that kind of thing you'll do. If you're Fox News, you could do that.
Notice you didn't serve in Vietnam, too.
I know. I was such a lazy ass. I was like Ted Nugent, crapping all over myself, except for the difference was I was like one.
Let's turn to the other news, the other big news that took place this week, which was – 2 or 3 days ago, I guess now, the Senate essentially filibustered the fast track authority, and then President Obama brought a bunch of corporatist Democrats into the White House and said, "Really, guys, come on."
Said mean things about Elizabeth Warren.
Yes, indeed, and then they got a deal in place where there would be a separate vote on the other provisions that have been tied into the fast track authority, things like currency manipulation bill, things like special preference for the African continent on some issues, one or two others. And So as of yesterday, at least the procedural hurdle, in other words, debate has been closed on right. whether to go forward with the vote for the fast track.
You got those 10 or so pro-trade Democrats.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, pro-trade I also think is sort of a misnomer, too.
It
I don't
is a
like
misnomer.
The framing.
Let's call it pro this crappy trade bill.
Exactly. Right. And we're going to see.
I'm for trade. Now, I'm not for trade where capital can move freely anywhere and labor can't, or where we don't, you know, that makes it so that the whole thing is a joke. I'm also, you know, obviously environmental things. I think we should trade with people because we should engage other countries, and that's one of the ways you do it. But you don't throw your economy out the window as part of that.
Well, and also, I think in the case of the TPP, we're really destroying our regulatory structure. And I want to move on to this story about the Volcker rule and the implications of that. But your senator, Portman, is basically saying that he is going to raise an amendment to include in the Fast Track Authority the currency manipulation essentially bill that is now going to get its own vote. It's unclear whether or not that will muck things up, but the real fight is going to end up being in the
Portman
House.
Saying he's going to support that now?
Well, he's saying he's going to make sure that it's in the
He's hysterical. I mean, this is the guy that was Bush's trade rep. The guy's never met a trade deal he doesn't like.
But of
you
course.
Know what? When polls start showing him losing to his Democratic opponents here, which they do,
that's what that's
nobody
about.
Knows who the hell he is. He's scared as hell right now because he knows he can easily be portrayed as just the corporate kiss up that he is.
You so got Strickland out polling Portman now, is my understanding. Is that right?
Yeah, that is true. That is exactly right.
So that explains why he's doing that, and he knows that's going to be that amendment's going to fail. He's going to raise it. That amendment probably failed because of those 10 Democrats who have agreed to go the other route. But the real fight's going to be in the House. And it really is going to be a function, I believe, because I think the number of Democrats that you're going to get that are going to defect, I think, is going to be fairly minimal. And I don't know how fluid that is. The real question is how
defect
many
from voting for it.
Yes. I mean, yeah, exactly.
I'm interested to see that because, you know, the Progressive Caucus, you know, who in times past, and I don't want to disparage them. I think that they've done the best they can under certain circumstances, and they haven't been as tough sometimes as some of us would like, but I think the culture has changed, and they were much more isolated in the past in a way that they're not now. So I'm interested to see if 20 or 30 of them could stand up and not vote for this, because if they could, I think the thing could go down potentially.
It really is a function of how many Republicans also sort of, I guess, defect.
That's what I mean. I think Republicans worried about Tea Party challenges from the right. There's a decent number of them who are going to vote against this thing, and some who just, you know, really do believe the conspiracy stuff, not the legitimate things wrong with this, the conspiracy, the kind of like the UN will be taking over the country kind of crap. Welcome on this issue.
And but let's talk about this one thing Elizabeth Warren said about this deal is that this could actually, because of the nature and we've talked about it quite a bit on this program, and on Monday we got a tech day here, but we're going to play an interview that I did for Ring of Fire with Dean Baker, and about sort of the regulatory structure and the investor state board that determines these things. On Wednesday, Canadian Finance Minister Joe Oliver gave a speech in New York. And he was basically saying that the Volcker Rule, which, of course, is a big part of the 2010 Dodd-Frank financial regulations, violates NAFTA. Now, the Volcker Rule basically says says to U.S. banks, you can't speculate in securities for your own profit. Like, you're not in that business anymore. You can broker for your clients, but that's it. If the government is going to backstop your funds.
Yes.
Now, banks, however, are U.S. banks are allowed to hold U.S. government debt in their own accounts because that's obviously a much safer investment. Those same banks aren't allowed to trade in Canadian government bank debt. I mean, excuse me, Canadian government debt. And the Canadians say, well, That is not allowed under the rules of NAFTA. You cannot favor the U.S. banknote, Treasury notes versus the Canadian Treasury notes. Now, the U.S. Treasury says no. Canada could bring an action to an arbitration board set up by NAFTA and fight this. And in which case, it would either overturn that part of the law, or they would somehow, I don't know, give them financial compensation. Now,
right.
Canada may decide not to pursue this. Under the TPP, it wouldn't just be the offending government that would be able to pursue this. It would be the Canadian banks. And it could be any other bank that felt that they were being prohibited. So the TPP gives even that much more power to corporations. And in this instance, you could see basically something like Dodd-Frank more or less be, if not overturned, the U.S. government would have to pay to maintain enforcement of Dodd-Frank.
Yeah. I mean, we'd have to pay a fine to do that. That's exactly right. So, that's a big problem that many of us have with this that I think, the president is just choosing to kind of brush off and pretend isn't there. I don't know what else to say about that. Your argument is almost just like, it's not what you say it is. Yes, it is. No, it's not. And it's kind of like, well, it's there in the text. Obviously, most people can't see that, aren't allowed to. So that's a big problem. And that, I feel like this is where this whole fight gets bogged down. Which is clearly, if you felt comfortable with all this stuff, you'd just put it out there. And it's sort of like, I don't know what the end goal is here, because I really don't. I have to believe that looking at this, if you've learned anything from the past, you can't believe that this thing is going to work. And the whole, just trust me, I'm the president now. It's different. That act has kind of gotten old.
Did you read Matt Taibbi's piece on this? Because he thinks that the idea of attacking Elizabeth Warren personally and sort of attacking the left, all the hippie punching, is really to distract from this, and is really as a way of sort of that this is a conscious effort that they made. This is part of their strategy. We're going to sort of like sister soldier the left on this as a way of sort of triangulating and getting the Republicans on board.
I haven't read Taibbi's piece, although now you've got me interested in reading it. That makes a lot of sense. I think there's a number of sort of things you can do with that. One is, the kinds of Republicans who you want on board, your Chamber of Commerce types, are going to enjoy the most if you're beating up on Elizabeth Warren and being on the opposite side on something like that. So some that maybe are a little scared of Tea Party pressure and some other kinds of pressure, that I think that's partially a way of winning them over. But as with all attacks, when you attack an individual, then you make them have to defend themselves as opposed to coming after the deal. You know what I mean?
It seems to me, not just a space for the Chamber of Commerce, but people who are sort of like marginally, like, they want to demonize Obama, but they also want to demonize the left. And so it's sort of a...
Well, I mean, the ones who are personally inclined to be Chamber of Commerce types, but would be scared maybe otherwise because they'd have the Tea Party going after them. And so now they can say, look, see, I'm voting against Elizabeth Warren. Must be good. That kind of thing, So the people that – the ones who really want to vote for this, and let's be honest, that's probably the majority of them. But some of them who run on social issues and come from, more evangelical, more rural districts, places where people are more against these kinds of things – which are a lot of Republicans, at the very least have to worry about a primary potentially. You already have that happening with a couple of Republicans. We've got people stepping out to primary them. And we saw what happened with Eric Cantor, and they did certainly. And so I think there, not to mention a number of people in the Senate, but certainly that was the Cantor one for those in the House, I'm sure is fresh on their minds. So they need that. They need to have Elizabeth Warren. She's now famous enough that she's a good foil.
Right.
If the foil is somebody else, Jeff Merkley or something, well, not as many people have heard of him. That doesn't really work as well. So I do think that's part of it. I think that's part of it. I think putting the left on the defense, so people have to sit there and respond to the charges and repeat the same crap and aren't as free to go on offense. I think this is all a part of it. You know, and so he's chosen to make this a really big deal. And I mean, there's a cynical view of Obama doing this because he's coming out of office soon and, you know, what opportunities he'll have. He'll have opportunities no matter what. So I'd be a little shocked if he's doing it just for that. I just don't get, you know, I mean, I think he's doing it more because he thinks legacy, you know, in the way Bill Clinton can still say he passed NAFTA. But in the end, as history's gone on, that's not necessarily been looked at by many who as a good thing. I mean, there's people that will hate Clinton no matter what he did on the right, but a lot of people who would be more inclined to like Clinton or who have seen the effects of NAFTA don't like what he did as much. And I don't see why they don't, you know, is it better to have something passed, even if it's something that people often say, wow, that really finished off our manufacturing sector, didn't it? I don't know. You know, but
well, it's interesting. Dylan Matthews, I think it is, in Vox, had a piece critical of Bernie Sanders' perspective on this, that it is because he's basically saying, like, look, this is going to open up opportunities for other countries. Labor force is going to raise their standard of living. And, you know, and if you're really concerned about poverty, they're poor, too. But, I mean, I think, you know,
But are there labor standards in this? Because I've seen none. It doesn't. I mean, if this really did raise the standard of living in some of these other countries in an equitable way, that would be one thing. And then we'd have an argument we'd have to have, right? It might hurt Americans in certain ways, American workers, but maybe if it helped workers in other countries to rise up, which is better for our foreign policy, it's better for a variety of things. But, you know, that's not what's happened. It's helped those at the top in other countries. It's helped oligarchs, but the people who are still making pennies, you know, an hour, it's not helping them. I mean, so
this is what we do know. We do know that 80% of the countries involved in this right now already have essentially free trade with the United States or are under some type of free trade agreement. A. B, we don't really know what is in the deal, so we can't really measure how much it's going to help other countries. See, you know, like you.
But let's be honest. I mean, I don't mean to cut you off. I'll let you finish. But let's be honest. When something is negotiated in private by a group of people who tend to mostly be millionaires and have a specific set of interests, let's be honest.
So cynical.
I mean, you know.
So cynical, Cliff.
I know.
I mean, look at how well it's been for Mexico, right? I mean.
Yeah, they have no problem with it now.
Millions
awesome.
of campesinos off of small farms. Mexican corn is 50 cents more expensive than an American ear of corn. It has, I don't know to what extent NAFTA inflamed the drug wars down there by putting a lot of young men out of, you know, desperately looking for jobs. It certainly
also
drove a lot of people across the border.
Opened the road a little more to some of them getting to other places to be able to sell those drugs for a lot more money, like parts of our country.
Yeah, well, it also drove a lot of people out of the country to look for work. I mean, so I don't know. I'm not able to measure that part of it. But the real issue here is a whole set of regulatory structure that I know is not necessary to achieve that goal. And, you know, I don't know. When I see criticism like that, it is one of those things that I find really annoying about that. This is that, like, okay, yeah, there are policy arguments here, but let's be honest. Like you say, we don't have the opportunity to see these documents. And so it really becomes down to a sheer political fight. And so to say, like, it's unfair to make this about the middle class, where there's no evidence that the middle class is going to pay for the idea of jobs shifting somewhere, right? Is intellectually dishonest, is also in and of itself just BS, because this isn't about that. If it was about that, we would have access. There'd be some symmetry to the information here. The information would not be just in the hands of the corporations that were involved in these negotiations. So I find criticism like that to be very disingenuous and really missing the point.
And when you've been around long enough, Not to say that we're old, Sam. We're just hitting our stride. But when you've seen a few of these things and you've learned that anything that is not debated in a completely transparent atmosphere, whether it's how cops are going to treat criminals or often non-criminals on the street, whether it's how we're going to conduct a war in a foreign country, whether it's an energy meeting with Dick Cheney or a trade deal or anything else, how we should handle prisoners for the CIA, when it's, you know, I mean, granted, the CIA can't really just debate most things out in the open, but it could have done a better job than it did in terms of who was included on that list. You know, these are things, that's the whole theory behind democracy, is, you know, transparency, everybody having understanding and being able to vote on things leads to the right conclusion. Whereas we, you know, is that always true? Not necessarily. But what we do know is when things are argued behind closed doors with very specific interests present and not other people, we know how human nature works. I mean, that's just common sense.
Cliff, all right. We only got a couple minutes left here. And before you go, I wanted to get your reaction to this. All right. Jeb Bush, totally changing topics here, and later I'm going to be talking about Russ Feingold running, which I know you're excited about. We can talk about that in the future.
And I was going to say Russ Feingold, awesome. Okay, go ahead.
And we can also talk in the future date about the idea of George Pataki running, because he hasn't quite declared
yet. Please, can we talk about that? Because that's hilarious.
Yes, we will in the future.
That's going to make Carly Fiorina look like a heavyweight.
All right, but first, what I want to do is play you this clip, and this is coming from Fox News, okay? And they have actually assembled, and I've got this clip. They have actually assembled the numerous positions Jeb Bush has taken over the past couple of days.
Now, Jeb,
you may not be able to hear this, but I'm going to play it, and it's basically – Jeb, I will give you the play-by-play after I play it. It's just about 15 seconds long. But it's Jeb. Basically, I mean, when people talk about flounder, this is what flounder is.
I would have, and so would have Hillary Clinton, just to remind everybody, and so would have almost everybody that was confronted with the intelligence they got.
Yeah, I don't know what that decision would have been. That's a hypothetical, but the simple fact is mistakes were made.
Knowing what we know now, what would you have done? I would have not engaged. I would not have gone into Iraq.
Well, Jeb Bush's evolving answers this week to the question, knowing what we do today, would you still have invaded Iraq?
So there you have it. Jeb Bush's evolving question, says Chris Wallace, the evolving answers to the question of knowing what we know today, would you still have invaded Iraq? He said, I would have. Then he said, I didn't understand the question. I won't answer.
Back then.
Because it's a hypothetical. I mean, and then he said, now I would not have.
I get them when they equate all this stuff too. Let's get this out there honestly. By two people who have served us back to back as Secretary of State and have run for president, Hillary Clinton and John Kerry, was that a very bad vote in 2003? Yes, it was. It doesn't mean that that was tantamount to sending our troops in. And I don't believe under similar circumstances that any Democrat would have sat there and sent our troops into a war in Iraq and have taken their eye off the ball in Afghanistan and what we needed to be doing when it came to Al-Qaeda. That's part one. Part two is watching these guys, you know, do that stuff. Of course, they could try to bring Hillary into it or anybody, any Democrat for that matter, they can. But watching them sit there and because Marco Rubio's done the same thing. He's not getting hit for it right now, but he switched his position on this. He said a few months ago that he would have gone in still. Now he wouldn't. And they all act like, you know, Judith Miller's book has some truth to it, even though she was taken apart by John Stewart, among others. And that, you know, this was something of, oh, it wasn't the Bush administration. It wasn't. We know all this by now. We know curveball and we know aluminum tubes and we know about the, you know, the mushroom cloud and all the propaganda that Condi did and that the administration did. And sadly, even to a certain degree, Colin Powell did. Cheney, Wolfowitz, this is like their full-time thing. They stovepiped information. They took what they wanted. They disregarded the rest. These guys wanted a war. They were all on PNAC, which, by the way, Jeb Bush signed.
Project New American Century, right?
Yes, they wanted this for a long time. And as Wolfowitz said, as Richard Clark said in his book very, very infamously, there are no good targets. Or was it Rumsfeld? There's no good targets to hit. in Afghanistan, so we should bomb Iraq. Well, Richard Clark standing there sort of with his jaw dropping. I mean, they wanted this. They wanted it for a long time for a variety of reasons. Oil, making certain elements of the Likud in Israel happy, and a variety of other things. And so, you know, this was a tragedy and a disaster, and they brought it about because they wanted it. There's no intelligence problem here. There's no, oh, well, Hillary voted for it. No, she voted to give the president the jurisdiction, well, not jurisdiction is not the right word, but the ability that Congress approved to go in. They did this. They broke it. All right? And so that's what where people need to keep their eye on the ball. And I hope Hillary and her people develop a good answer, you know, along the lines of what I just said, because whatever you want to say about that vote, and I do think it was a bad vote, again, it was not the same thing as what these jackasses
did. Right, of course. And look, you know, Krugman had a good piece today reminding people that, you know, Jeb Bush's advisors include Paul Wolfowitz, who said, well, weapons of mass destruction, one thing we could all agree on, and that's why we went in. And
he's the one who said that
George
also
Bush.
Said that the cost was going to be nothing and
right.
we're getting flowers thrown.
Yeah, I mean, like, so let's be honest here. And so Jeb Bush, the most interesting thing about this is just like how incompetent of a candidate do you have to be sort of thrown off your game by getting what would probably be the most obvious question possible.
Yeah,
right.
How are you not ready for this? How do you screw that up? How is it that you have not been prepared? You know, I mean,
when you sit down with your advisors,
your brother stood
2 years ago, when you sit down with your advisors, your closest advisors, the two or three, two people that you would talk to first about this, say like, hey, should I even contemplate this? The first thing that seems to me that you would be sitting around as you're smoking your cigars in your study,
drinking your very expensive brandy,
is how would I answer Iraq? Like, that seems to me to be the first question that
you think to yourself, look, your name is Bush. Inevitably, whether you want to get removed from it or not, you're going to be asked about it. So what are the two or three things you're going to probably be asked? You're probably going to get a Katrina question at some point.
Yep.
Let's let them put it out there so we can help Jeb to prepare. You know what else, Jeb? You're probably going to get a question about the economy and what you would have done to stave off when the economy crashed in 2008 when your brother was in office. I mean, these are some obvious questions, I would think. All right, Iraq and the economy being the two biggest ones. But, yeah, there'll be a Katrina one. There'll probably be a Social Security one, considering your brother tried to privatize that. These are things you might want to prepare for, Jeb.
Well,
you know,
it's
just a thought.
I'm happy to see that he hasn't. But, Cliffy, as always, a pleasure. Talk
My
to you next
pleasure,
week.
As always. Thank you for having me on.
Cliff Schechter, ladies and gentlemen. So long, Cliff. Thanks.
Take care. Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, the wonderful Judy Gold. We'll be right back after this.
Driving on night, you could be a shadow beneath the street light behind my home. Driving on night, I sure miss.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a pleasure. It is an immense pleasure for me to welcome back to this program the wonderful Judy Gold. Hello, Judy.
Oh, Sam, what a nice intro. Thank you. How are you?
I understand that you're in a Broadway play.
Well, I would say Broadway, but it's off Broadway.
Okay. Well, near Broadway play.
It's on 50th, so it's, you know, it's right off of, you know, Broadway only means the size of a theater, so.
What theater are you in?
I'm at New World Stages, which is on 50th between 8th and 9th. I'm in the musical, Clinton the Musical.
What? Bill Clinton?
Clinton the Musical. I play Eleanor Roosevelt and Linda Tripp.
Oh, my God.
And it is hilarious.
Really? Who wrote this?
So these guys from Australia, the Hodge brothers, wrote it, and we workshopped it. So there's a little Judy in there.
Of course.
And we all sort of, you know, contributed our thoughts and feelings. And, you know, it's a 90-minute, really hilarious look at the Clinton presidency. And Monica and Hillary do not, you know, Monica does not look like a slut, and Hillary does not look like a bitch. And so there are poignant moments where you realize, oh, that's why Hillary stayed with him. But other than that, it is hilarious. And I'm telling you right now, bipartisan hilarity. Republicans love it and Democrats love it.
Well, of course, you've got to say that.
But it's true.
But, I mean, do Republicans really go to the theater?
Yes! I swear to God, I'm not kidding. The producer's husband is like the biggest Republican ever.
Well, but
he's been there six times.
Well, of course,
wait,
he has to.
I'll do someone else. So my friend who works at the Jewish Community Center.
All right, there you go, your friend.
No, I'm not done.
Yeah.
She said, oh, you're in that? My friend, this woman, Christina, who is the biggest Republican in the world, works at the J, and she said she had seen it, and it was hilarious. So I don't know the Christina woman.
Wow. So we have almost evidence of one Republican going to the theater.
No. I'm telling you, there's more. My neighbor, Cy.
Judy, come on. You don't need to. I mean, listen, there's no Republicans listening to this show.
Oh, right.
You don't need to pretend.
But they do like it, but, you know, who cares?
Right.
Anyway,
now I was going to say,
we know they don't have a sense of humor, so.
Now, this is a musical.
I'm sorry?
It's a musical.
It's a musical, and I dance and sing,
you know,
Sam.
My first reaction was like, I didn't know you sing, but I do know you sing. Because I remember from, like, literally before I ever met you, seeing your clip on, like, stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
Of you singing It's Judy's Show.
Oh, right, yes.
That's
my dream of my variety show.
That was
It's Judy's Show!
Yeah. Yes, that's it. And I, like, for years, I loved that. I mean, I can't remember even the context in which it would come up.
The context, remember I had a stupid spit curl on the side of my head? Don't even ask, okay?
Right.
So I had this spit curl, like, what's your name, had one on the forehead, but... You know, I can't remember anything. But, you know, it was the 80s. I had this little spicker on. So I had this fantasy that I would have my own show in the 60s, like a variety show. And I'd open the show sliding down a big spit curl singing, It's Judy's Show!
That it is. That is always stuck with me. Now, I was just saying that I don't watch that much comedy anymore, I guess. I don't know. I don't know why. But, like,
right.
I just don't have that much
comedy. Children and a job.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, okay.
And but I've watched 2 half-hour comedies this week where you showed up, and maybe not this week, maybe in like the past 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
And you did not show up in Game of Thrones. I'll just say that. So I didn't see you there. But I saw you in Louis C.K.'s show. That was hilarious. You played a fellow parent of his who really beat the hell out of him. I mean, emotionally.
Right.
And that
he's such a good director.
What is it like? I mean, I've worked with Louis, but you tell me what was it like for, I mean, what does he do? He just basically says what? Go ahead.
You know, basically he wants truth, honesty, and reality, you know, and he's generous as well. So, and you trust him, he trusts you and you trust him, and I don't know. We had such a good time. The last
scene. But what does that mean? I mean, look, every time we hear.
Because, you know, you can always tell when a director is like, you know, no, know. You know, he trusted me because I said to him, you know, I should wear an apron. He said, oh, good idea. The first take of the phone call, the first scene, we had done it several times. He said, just do it. The first time we did it, he said, just do it. And I just did it the way I would do it. And then we did it with direction a few more times, maybe four or five times. And he took the first take. So, and he wrote me the nicest email thanking me. And I mean, who does that? But, you know, look, the show's successful and he knows what he's doing and he's right. Not an a-hole. Can I say a-hole on the Majority Report?
Yes.
Is that about it?
You can say b-hole. I don't know what that means, but.
Can I say c-hole?
Sure. You can say the entire alphabet hole if you want.
Okay.
But wait a second. Now, what people, when actors say, like, he's generous or, like, we trust him, nobody knows what that means. You have to be more explicit.
So what I, you know, he was generous in a way where he was, you know, he wrote me an email. You know, would say, great job. You nailed it. That was great. Let's do it this way. You know, he communicates.
Right.
He's a good communicator. You know, and you're not scared of him. He's not like a scary figure in the corner. I don't know. You've been on so many TV shows. You know, I was on sitcoms, you know, and I would always see like these young executives in the corner whispering.
Right.
And all I ever wanted to do was go up to them and say, all right, I'll pack my things up. I swear to God, every time they had a little meeting in the corner, I was like, I'm fired. I mean,
I think that's what people don't realize is that, like, when you're doing this, when you're acting, when you're doing it, you're trying not to be self-conscious at all. And so what it does is it makes you extremely vulnerable because you have no sense, and you need to have no sense of how you're registering to other people. And so all you have is basically other people to give you a sense of whether or not you're totally effing up or you're being funny.
Right, but you know, in a sitcom situation, you've got the network executives and you got the director and you got this one's manager and that one's agent and that executive producer and that. So you have you know, all these different opinions. With him, it's like
it's just
him.
Right.
And he's so clear about what he wants. He's just really clear. Like, he would give me a note, and it was exactly right. I get it. You know, some people give you notes, and you're like, what the hell are you talking about? You know what I mean?
It's completely confusing. And so
right.
That was it. And then I saw you, I saw the first episode of Gaffigan's show.
Oh, is that the first one?
Yeah, it's on. It is.
Oh, I got to post that. It's on today, right?
I don't know. Like, I think it's on. I'm not even sure what network it's on, but it's on his website.
Right.
JimGaffigan.com. And they posted the episode. And I think it's on Comedy Central and, like, maybe Cartoon Network or some other network. I think it's
on both.
Or something. And it was. I mean, I thought it was very funny, but it was also, I was blown away by, like, how many.
Oh, my God. Right? How many celebrities and
Chris Rock,
figures.
John Stewart, four different.
Every newscaster
like,
ever.
Yes.
Rachel Maddow.
Maddow, right. Morning Joe, O'Donnell, Jake Tapper, the guy from New York One. It was unbelievable.
It was great.
I mean, the production value was huge on that show, too, it seems.
Yeah. I mean, and he just emailed me, will you do it? I said, absolutely.
Yeah, he's fine.
Thank God for email. That's
indeed.
All I have to say.
So you've been very busy.
Well, yeah. So the show I'm in that you have to come see, I'm not kidding. Sam, you will love it. It's satire, and it's campy, and it's funny, and you'll love it. Okay, so that's Clinton the Musical.
Right.
And then, yeah, I've been doing that, which takes, you know, my body is not, these people in the show are all went to, like, conservatory and Juilliard, and I'm like, oh, my God, and they're all there on time, and they have work ethic. I'm a comic. You know, like, I get there, they're like, Judy, you're 4 minutes late for half hour. I'm like, so what? I'm going to still be on the stage on, you know? Like, but it's like, you know how I'm used to going to a club. I go in like 3 minutes before I have to go on stage because I can't stand hanging out and watching other people and, you know, I just want to go there and do my work. And, you know, this, you got to be there. There's rules. And then you got to hang up your clothes.
And you got to be polite to other people. Let me ask you this about
the
actors.
I know. It's unbelievable. And they all do it. They're all so disciplined. And I'm like, really? So that's great. And then my podcast just came out last week, and I got a great review on the Huffington Post. And Sam,
what?
I really want you on it.
Were you getting your podcast got reviewed on the Huffington Post?
Yes. I
didn't even know that was a thing.
Well, I guess someone else reviewed it and they picked up the review. It's called Kill Me Now with Judy Gold. Kill Me Now, because basically that's my mantra. And, you know, I talk to people about what really, truly, from the mundane to the extraordinary, what pisses them off the most. And it's really fascinating because, you know, I don't want to do the regular interview of storytelling. And when you're pissed off, you're passionate.
Right.
And it's really interesting what pisses people off and what, you know,
there's a pretty narrow bandwidth of stuff that pisses me off. But wait, I want to ask you more about, I would love to do your podcast, and Pete will link to it on majority.fm. But let me ask you about this, about the being in the musical, because mm-hmm. I've done, I did a play, but many years ago, and I've done a bunch of readings over the years, and some that were like stage readings.
Right.
Some that 2 or 3 days worth of rehearsal, some that would just show up that day. And here's the thing that has always struck me about, and I experienced this too a little bit in the sitcom world, but there's, you know, it's not all actors, you know, some of them are comedians mm-hmm. and I don't know anything about what they're talking about. Like all the actors come in, it seems to me, all the musical theater actors, and they know about every production, and they're just like, have you seen Janice Stevenson's latest thing? And they're just like, oh my God, yes, it was amazing. It was nothing compared to what she did in, the Berkshires.
Oh my God. They do these references like, and this is, they're always like, Pierre Jacques is in the audience. I'm like, really? No clue. And then they're like, they'll say stuff like, you know, he was in this, but he originated the role in that.
Right.
And then who was the other? And I'm like, oh, my God. It's unbelievable, the stuff they know. And, you know,
like you and I can't even parody it because we don't know enough to even cite anybody.
Right. So all they do is they're always like, Stephen Rashendo Calabria is in the audience, and they're all like, oh, my God, seriously? That's great. And I swear to God, all I do is go back to my dressing room and Google the person and then act like I know who they were talking about.
I found, like, it was really complicated at the time because some people would go the way that the director would sometimes say, like, did you ever see Kenny Stevenberg in the second rendition of Rent? No. All
right.
Well, try and mix, the so-and-so's performance.
I know.
I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking
about.
No
reference. I have no idea. But then again, this is really fascinating to me. So there's a lot of, the crew is very young. You know, they all just graduated. A lot of them, they're out working for a year or two, right? Stage management, costuming, you know, whatever. They have college degrees, and they're very talented. I asked a 24-year-old crew member if she knew who Mitch McConnell is.
Mm.
No idea. So, and I am always, you know how I am, I have to read constantly, and I have to know what the hell's going on. And I literally, I'm not kidding. Most of them are just, they don't know about, I come in and tell them what's going on. Oh, did you hear that? It's fascinating to me that they will engross themselves into learning a character, but then have no idea what's going on in the world.
Well, that's the difference between, like, sort of a comedian and an actor, isn't it, on some level?
But, you know, there are so many actors that know what the hell's going on. Like Ben Affleck, I mean, he knows everything.
Well, Ben Affleck knows that, but, I mean, that's, I think, you know, to a certain extent.
Right, I know. I mean, and there's, you know, the older ones.
Are you hanging
know
around with Ben Affleck these days?
Oh, my God. He's my sperm donor.
Matt Damon knows more, though. You know that, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's Matt Damon went to Harvard.
Did he go to Harvard, or was he just in that movie where his character went
to Harvard? No, he went to Harvard, right? And the other one kind of went to Harvard.
Who, Affleck? Really. Affleck didn't go to Harvard? I don't know that I remember
Yeah,
that.
One of them went to Harvard, I'm telling you.
All right. I knew they both were in Cambridge.
Yeah.
I guess Affleck went to Occidental, Michael's telling me. I don't even know where that is.
That's
in California.
Oh, really? Okay.
God, you're not Jewish anymore.
No, I've
Sam. How I have to know. You know, we worked on a very important ad campaign together.
That's right.
Which is where I think we really bonded.
That's right.
Although I've been a fan of yours forever, and I think you
I cast you in Beat Cops 15 years ago.
Now. Beat Cops. Yep. But you're very telegenic, Sam.
Oh, thank you.
I don't understand why you are not one of the people on that have their own little hour on certain networks.
Okay, I don't know what to tell you. I have no answer for that.
Okay. Anyway, and you're very smart. But the thing is that, you know, during this process of this ad campaign, you were in the process of having a second child.
That's right.
And you know, I could say you were stressed. I would say that.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I gotta
say, how is that going?
I'll tell you how it's going. Boys, significantly easier than girls, in my
that is correct.
Personal experience. And, like, Saul is...
I love that name, by the way.
He you know, he's two now, so there's a little bit of, like, he'll come up to you and just look at you. A cute kid, and then he just smacks you right in the face.
Right, right, right.
Just to see, like, what happens. And you go, don't do that. It's not nice. And he go, and then he'll cry because he feels like you're making him feel bad, you know?
Right.
But
God, you're such a good child psychologist.
But aside from that, he is, like, super easy. And Mila, you know, takes care of him. So it's actually gone fairly well. You still got the problem that, like, on the weekends, got to be home for 3 hours because the kid
naps.
Let
me tell you something. Let me just tell you something. You think it's bad now? You know, I can't tell you how many 7 o'clock soccer games in the freezing rain in Riverside Park, where it's like 40 degrees cooler than Broadway, standing there acting interested.
All right, well, how old are your kids? You got
Okay, so now Henry's 18.
Wow.
Ben is 13. Now, Ben is 13, and he's taller than me. So he's about 6'2", 6'3" now.
Named after his sperm donor.
Say that again?
Ben Affleck?
Yes, Ben. Exactly. And we named him Ben after Ben. Anyway, so he's about, and he won the middle school athletic, Manhattan Middle School Athletic League. You know, he won MVP of the basketball, and they were undefeated, and he was captain. So he's a great kid, but he's really getting annoying. And then Henry's 18. He's at Indiana University.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, now he's home. And, you know, the boys, you know, I've always liked having boys because I'm sort of, you know, I'm very athletic and outdoorsy,
right.
And
right.
I hate shopping. I hate girl stuff. I hate it. I like to ride my bike and play baseball. You know, I'm an outdoor kind of lesbian, but I love getting dressed up and wearing makeup and, you know. Anyway, the point is that Mother's Day, I get nothing. I don't get a call. So finally, I call them. I said, do you guys have anything to say to me? And Henry says, no, why? It's not Father's Day. And I'm like, I hate you. I hate both of you. They call me, they're mad, their mom and dad.
That's great.
No, it's annoying. But Ben,
are your kids like smartasses? Like, are they funny? Have you, like, trained them to be funny?
Oh my God, they're so hilarious. I mean, we laugh so much. It's like, here's the thing. I have no parenting skills, really, except, and they, you know, they're awful to me. They'll say, you know, we're very sarcastic. I don't know where we got that from. But, you know, yeah, we're very, and they can say, they can say mean, horrible things to me, and they will not get in trouble if it's funny.
That, you know, that's a problem, because I have that dynamic with Myla, and, you know, to a certain extent with Saul, but with Myla, I have that dynamic, but my wife does not have that dynamic. So it sends slightly mixed messages to Myla. Like,
right,
you know,
now,
if she says something to me that is really nasty, but genuinely funny,
right,
I'll just like fist bump her. I'll be like, good one. But if she says that to Nikki, Nikki will fly off the handle. That's the problem.
Well, what kind of sense of humor does your wife have?
Not the kind where she's going to have her 9-year-old daughter say you know, smart ass things to her.
But see, the thing is, if they're funny, she, I don't know. She's not a comic. What does she
do? Right. She's a documentary filmmaker.
Well, she's serious.
Yeah.
So yeah, you need, I want them to know what's funny. Like, they've been watching The Simpsons and South Park since I don't know how long. All the other mothers are like, oh my God, you let them watch that. But it's like they know what funny is. And then every night, I'm not kidding, 13-year-old Ben, we watch The Daily Show and Larry Wilmore. And now if I laugh at something, he'll say to me, okay, why was that funny? Or if he doesn't laugh at something and the audience does, he'll say, I know why they're laughing, but I didn't think it was funny. Like, he really gets it. So, you know, I don't know. I love humor. Humor is so important.
Here's what's disturbing. Myla is going through a phase where she loves Jim Carrey. And
God.
And
is she doing the faces and running around like a mental patient?
Here's the part that is driving me crazy. She is using as a catchphrase, I can barely say the words without the bile rising in me.
Okay, go.
You know how he says, I like it a lot.
Oh, God.
Like, just to even hear it in my house is so grating. And so, like, I'm telling Myla, I'm like, I think you're ready to watch Holy Grail. And she's like, we watched Fletch the other day because I thought that would be, and she sort of, and she liked that. So I'm like, I'm trying to sort of like push her in a different direction.
Okay, let me just tell you something. Ben, everything you say to him, I'll say, Ben, can you bring the dry, can you bring the recycling down? You're racist. Ben, do you have money for lunch? That's racist. Everything I say is racist.
Are there parts that you're taking out you're not telling us that you're saying?
That's the thing. No. I happen to not be a racist, but he just takes crap. Like, and then he'll come out with these lines. Here's the problem. I've been to school. I get, I just got a letter the other day. I get these emails, and the problem is I went in for the parent-teacher conferences, and he is disruptive, and he is mini-me, right?
Right.
But the teachers are like, the problem is that he is really funny. So they are laughing, but they have to discipline him. So here's what I got. This is from his art teacher the other day. Ben was removed from class yesterday for being disruptive and rude, foot on table, interrupting me while I was explaining directions, etc. Today he came to class in a weird medieval costume complete with breasts.
What? Where is he getting that costume? Did he leave the house that way?
Well, this is what happened. They're doing Two Gentlemen of Verona, and he's playing a woman's part. So he's like, Mommy, can I borrow one of your dresses? I'm like, no. He goes into my ex's closet and takes like some, like, you know, $400 Tory Burch top.
I don't know.
Without telling her, and then takes a rolled up sweater and puts it underneath to make breasts and walks around school like that. And then the humanities teacher, who's the coolest guy in the world, took a picture of it and sent me an email going, Ben. Like, he, you know. But he's fearless. And, you know, I got that, and I was cracking up. I wanted to send it to everyone, and my ex is like, that's it, he's punished. I'm like, why? The fact that he's came out of me, and he's not, like, sitting in the corner of the classroom banging his head against the wall.
Eating paste.
Eating paste, right.
Wow.
Yeah, he's
your kids sound like, I mean, I've met your kids, but it was very brief. But the,
And also, he's got the girls over. They all have girlfriends now.
Right. What do you do about the phones?
So they have one friend whose mother, literally, when they come over, has a basket, and she makes them all put their phones in the basket.
Interesting.
And they hate going there, so they don't go there anymore. And the girl now has no friends. All right, so, I take it away. I won't answer him if he's not looking at me when we eat dinner. I will not do, you know, he has to put it away. But he's addicted. It was like Henry's eight, only 5 years older, but they didn't have iPhones.
Right.
You know, when he was like 13, 10, 11,
right.
12.
Right.
And, you
it's
know,
such
they
a
all,
new,
if
it's,
you,
it's such a new, it's such a new thing. For kids, it's so new. Like, you know, I remember having, I mean, I don't even think I had this when I was a kid, but they had, oh, you know what, I think around when they were nine, you had those handheld little football games. I don't know if you remember that like where it was literally just a dot of light and you would just run across a field. You wouldn't run, you'd just push the button and it would, this dot of light would go across the fields, like a little handheld Nintendo thing or something, but it was not even that. It was like a football game, and it would just go boodaloo, and that was it. And I remember playing that for hours, and if you look at it now, it would be like literally you can't find anything that is that rudimentary and that uninteresting that even exists today, and it was addictive. Like this, a phone, I mean, forget about it.
Okay, this is what I did. I took a piece of paper, we folded it into like a triangle, and we played like football across the desk.
Ah, that's smart.
Remember that?
Yeah.
And you had to get the thing over.
Oh, I thought this is what you did with your kid.
And then,
okay, right.
And what about like the hockey game with the little, you know, the with the wooden things, and you'd,
yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, foosball type of thing, or like
the very
things.
Little one.
Yeah, I remember those. Yeah.
Okay.
Of course.
With the hole at the end where
sure.
the puck would go. And you had to look at each other. And, you know, I walk in here, they're on the friggin' phones, like, constantly. Ben literally calls me from the other room. I have the tiniest apartment. Is the food here?
And so what do you do about it?
I will not respond.
And that's it? Is it working?
Right. No.
Okay.
Nothing I do works. Sam, nothing. It doesn't work. He's taller than me now. Here's the other thing. The other day I said, give me a hug. He's giving me a hug. I feel something. And he's texting while he's giving me a hug.
Well, you got to give him credit for that because that's not easy.
Well, first of all, I feel like this is the end of us. Like that watch, that Apple watch.
Right.
You know, so... Someone said that it tells you when you have to get up and walk around when you've been sitting too long.
That's not a bad thing.
What? You need a computer instead of your body? Like telling you what to do, when to walk around. It's so ridiculous. People are so not in tune with reality and people and communication. Look, they will never, ever be able to get stoned and go to Tower Records for 4 hours looking through albums.
That's true.
And what is greater than that? And you'd open the album, you'd take the cellophane off, and then you'd open it, and you'd play the whole thing, and you'd read the liner notes, and you know.
Wow. I didn't realize you were this sort of like get off my lawn.
Yeah. Oh, I'm very, this is what real, I feel like, honestly, I feel like I've changed since these phones came out, that I'm more stressed, that I, you know, I have to purposely not bring it. Last night I was sitting in a chair, I was watching I don't know, Rachel or something after the show. And I had this urge to get up and walk to the desk and go get my phone. And I was like, no. It's like literally this conscious thing where, like, no, you don't need it. Nothing happened. No one happened. You know, it's ridiculous.
Well, they've done studies where apparently you get a dopamine rush when.
Right. It's like that noise. Yeah. It's like when you gamble.
Yep.
But seriously, it's. I handwrite notes. I have stationery. I always handwrite notes to people if they have me over, anything. They then call me to thank me.
You see, you resent that. I mean, I'm writing this down right now.
No, I don't resent it. They say, oh, my God, thank you so much. I haven't had a handwritten note. And, like, I resent the fact that they don't even want to teach kids handwriting. Like, this is not evolution to me. Like having big thumbs and having, like, there's this guy in my mother's nursing home, Harold.
Yeah.
Who, which coincidentally was my father's name, who's always going to visit my mother because she gets the New York Times and she's the only one and he always tries to steal. But anyway, I don't know what's wrong with him, but he cannot lift his head up. So whenever he walks, his head is down. And every time he's in there, my mother's like, I don't know why the hell he's in here. I'm like, Ma, be thankful someone actually wants to spend time with you. Anyway, the other day I go in there. And he's in there, you know, and head down, the whole thing. Can't look up. And he said, oh, your mother and I were just watching a movie. And I was like, oh, was it on the floor? I mean, and then I thought, that's what we're all going to look like.
Because everyone's going to look
down, big thumbs.
Well, hopefully, Judy, something will happen. Hopefully what we'll have is massive global climate change. And
no, that's not happening. What are you talking about? You know, look, fracking is awesome. You know, look, there was a snowball in the winter, so that means there's no climate change.
There you go.
I don't know if you heard that congressman.
I have heard that congressman, of course.
Yeah.
Brought it into
and he's right. He had a snowball during a winter month.
Well, Judy, look, I know we're out of time here because we gotta
what?
Go.
I'm having such a good time.
I know, I'm enjoying it, but we gotta go. The show's our show's almost over. I got a bunch of stuff to catch up on.
Whatever.
But all right, what is the name of the play for people in New York? The musical.
Clinton the Musical. I'm not kidding. It's really hilarious. It's 90 minutes, and they have very inexpensive tickets. They're like, you know, $35. You know, on they have it on TKTS.
I don't
know, you know, they
very
have discount tickets.
I would call, but I don't know. We call it very inexpensive.
That's inexpensive.
It's not as expensive as other, but I don't know how to call it very inexpensive.
$35 for an off-Broadway. Do you know what you go to see these other shows? They're like $600.
Never been to a $600
show.
Shut
up. No. Anyway, so that and Kill Me Now, my podcast.
Right. That is
on iTunes. JudyGold.com.
That's very inexpensive.
Huh?
That's very inexpensive.
Right. You subscribe and then you rate it and you give me 5 stars. JudyGold.com. /iTunes. It really is funny. I have had Frank Conniff. You know Frank Conniff?
Of course. I just actually got a text. Somebody said that episode was great.
What about my Ted Alexandro episode?
I didn't see that. I haven't seen anybody comment on that one. I just saw one with Frank Conniff.
Whatever. Anyway, it's really funny. And right, you better get your ass on.
I will. I'll definitely get my ass on.
All right.
Judy Gold, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much, Judy. It was always
oh,
a pleasure.
Oh, my God, such a pleasure. Right. And have a wonderful weekend. I'll be working
okay.
All weekend.
Enjoy.
All right.
Bye.
So long.
Bye. Judy Gold, ladies and gentlemen. That was fun. All right. We'll do an extra, you know, 30 for members. Let's say goodbye to our non-members. I just want to remind you, though, sponsored by Credo Mobile. We got 1 month to get this deal. $100 off any phone, 25% off your data plan for a year. They will buy you out of your existing contract up to $350. They'll give you a credit on your Credo bill. They will give you up to $300 in trading credit for your current phone. You got to go over to Credo and find out how much it's worth to them. At credomobile.com/trade-in. But head to credomobile.com Bloomberg.com//majority report. You'll get this deal if you want to call in 800-966-1665 and offer code 501882. Go to the website, and we have that on there. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Coupon code majority, get 10% off. Buy crap from our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com. Have a great weekend. Give us a review on iTunes. See, that's what helps. Even Judy knows it. All right, we will be back in a moment. 646-257-3920. Oh, my God. Matt just linked to send me Judith Miller. I sit down with James O'Keefe and talk about the state of journalism today. I like the comments that follow it. John Bridges says, will there be any actual journalists present at the meeting? Someone else wrote, of course you do, dear. Wow. That's really something. Wow. Wow. All right. We'll be right back after this.